From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, the federal bench. President Trump is often criticized for not having any quote-unquote major accomplishments, but his judicial picks, Neil Gorsuch included, could have a more lasting impact than any bill he signs. Barring impeachment or resignation, these men, and they're almost all white conservative men, will have their jobs for life. How is this White House reshaping America through the courts? That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jamil Smith, contributing opinion writer at the Los Angeles Times. Now, the man being questioned in the next clip is Matthew Peterson. This was last week, and he was at his confirmation hearing. President Trump nominated him for a seat on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, one of the most prominent federal courts in the nation. Peterson had no trial experience, and he had some trouble with the questions from Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana.
Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
No.
State or federal court?
I have not.
Okay. Have you ever taken a deposition?
I was involved in taking depositions when I was associate at Wiley Ryan when I first came out of law school. But that was...
How many depositions?
I'd be struggling to remember.
Less than 10?
Yes.
Less than 5?
Probably somewhere in that range.
Peterson is no longer a nominee for that lifetime position. He withdrew even after the White House stood behind him after that series of questions, alleging that critics of his performance were, quote, trying to distract from the record-setting success that the president has had on judicial nominations. It's that success with appointing judges that we want to take a look at today with our guests. First up is Zoe Tillman, a legal reporter covering the federal courts for BuzzFeed News. Zoe, welcome to 1 year Later.
Thanks for having me.
So now, of course, we're called 1 year later for a reason. And of course, Trump's effort to reshape the judiciary has been one of his biggest accomplishments in that first year. How would you characterize his success?
He's really broken a lot of records, at least compared to his more immediate predecessors. He's had 18 judges confirmed so far this year, 12 circuit judges, which is definitely a record, six district court judges, a Supreme Court justice, lest we forget, earlier this year, Justice Neil Gorsuch. He's looking at another 160 or so vacancies to fill. He's got 43 nominees moving through the Senate. It's really been a bright spot for the White House and for Republicans in the Senate who have had some trouble following through on other legislative priorities this year.
Has the administration or have Republicans in Congress spoken about why this has been such a priority for them?
They have. These are lifetime appointments. You know, it's challenging getting them through. There's a whole process. But once they're on the bench, this is essentially forever. These will outlast this president, maybe a couple more presidents from now. So for Republicans and for a Republican president to get, you know, young conservative jurists onto the bench now has the potential to carry on a conservative way of interpreting the law and applying the law far beyond most anything else that they might do in the next 4 to 8 years.
Why are there so many openings on the federal courts for Trump to fill, Zoe? Did President Obama drop the ball, or is this due mainly to Republican obstruction during his terms?
So President Obama was criticized earlier on in his presidency by Democrats for not moving quickly enough on judges. They felt that it wasn't as much of a priority as it should have been for him early on in getting these seats filled. And then by the end of his second term, we did see Republicans who controlled the Senate holding up nominees, not holding hearings. The most high-profile example was the late Justice Scalia's Supreme Court seat, where President Obama had announced a nominee, D.C. Circuit Judge Merrick Garland, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, we're just not going to move on this. We don't think that we should do anything on this seat until the people decide in the November election. But beyond Garland, there were a number of seats where, you know, the Republicans decided, you know, they weren't going to schedule hearings or votes or have them come up in the Judiciary Committee.
I want to bring Kristen Clark into the conversation. She's the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law. Hello, Kristen.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Indeed. The Associated Press recently reported that 91% of Trump's nominees are white and 81% of them are male. Kristen, that's not a coincidence, is it?
No, not by any means. You have to work to achieve numbers like this. Our country is becoming an increasingly diverse nation by the day. During the Obama administration, we saw them doing work to address the historical underrepresentation of African Americans, women, Latinos, and other groups on our federal courts. During the Obama years, there were about 300 or so judges who were appointed to the bench. 42% of them were women. And we've seen that number drop dramatically to 18% under Trump. About 29% were African American and Latino. And one has to work hard to identify a single nominee who is either African American or Latino now. This administration is clearly working to turn the clock back and is reversing progress that had been made over the last several years. If we want our public, our nation, to have confidence in the courts, the courts should reflect the growing diversity of our nation.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kristen, on that point, there may be some people who hear this and say, well, why does this matter to me? I don't get in trouble. I don't end up in court. I'm not being sued. Can you explain the power of federal courts, these lower federal courts, in the lives of everyday Americans?
Oh, the courts are incredibly important. We tend to place a lot of focus on the Supreme Court, but the reality is that the Supreme Court only hears a couple dozen cases every year. In 2016, the Supreme Court heard 69 cases. When we look at district courts, there are 355,000 cases that were heard by district court judges in 2016, and 58,000 cases that were heard by appeals court judges during that same year. Mm. That represents about 99.9% of all cases and controversies across our country. So people should care about these courts, whether we're talking about controversies in the criminal justice space, voting rights, First Amendment, you know, any major issue in our country involving the Constitution or federal law. I mean, these are the judges who decide and resolve those controversies. They set precedents. They help to protect rights. So these courts matter a great deal.
Now, Zoe Tillman of BuzzFeed News, of course, there's been a resignation in this week of a federal judge. Can you explain exactly what happened there? Because, you know, for all that it seems like that never happens.
So in the Ninth Circuit, which covers most of the western United States, there's a judge named Alex Kaczynski. And earlier this month, the Washington Post published a story with accounts from several of Judge Kaczynski's former clerks accusing him of a range of misconduct, from inappropriate comments through sexual misconduct in chambers. And initially, the judge, you know, hadn't said he was going to step down. The court had announced a formal inquiry into his behavior. And then the Washington Post published a second story with more accounts from more women accusing this judge of more misconduct. And at that point, Judge Kaczynski announced that he would be stepping down. He said that he apologized if he had made anyone feel uncomfortable. He acknowledged, he said he had a sense of humor that not everyone might make some people uncomfortable, and he apologized for that. There hasn't been an acknowledgement of specific incidents that were alleged in some of these stories. But what this does is, you know, this opens up another appeals court seat on a very influential court. The Ninth Circuit covers California, so it's been a major court in terms of intellectual property issues, copyright issues. You know, it covers Silicon Valley and everything going on there. So it was a pretty high-profile resignation.
Right. And on that note, I want to bring in Elizabeth Wydra. She's the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which is a D.C.-based think tank and law firm. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Great to be with you.
Elizabeth, on that note, what Zoe was just talking about with Judge Kaczynski, it really does matter who the judge is in a particular case, does it not?
Yes, absolutely. You know, first of all, judges should be following the law. They should be following the Constitution's text, history, and values, and the law, applying it fairly to everyone. But, you know, you have, for example, on the appellate courts, there are going to be three individual judges on each panel considering these, you know, 50 to 60,000 or so cases that Kristen mentioned. And having someone who respects women, someone who respects civil rights, who understands the importance of environmental protections and does not have a particular political agenda that is opposed to these important aspects of American life is really important. And that's part of what's so troubling with these young, very ideological, in some cases, obviously not qualified judicial nominees that President Trump is putting forward. Because, you know, we talked about, you know, something like you talk about environmental rules. Well, mm-hmm. you could change those when you have a new president come in and have his own agency priorities. But when you have these judges on the bench and they issue rulings, as Zoe said, that's something that lasts long beyond the just 4 years or so of a particular president's term.
Kristen Clark, can you tell me some specific civil rights areas that are under threat thanks to these appointments?
So we want judges who are fair and independent, judges who will follow the law and interpret the Constitution fairly. But every day we see voter suppression in our country. Every day we see the ways in which race infects our criminal justice system. And in the civil rights space, those are the kinds of cases that come before courts every day. Challenges to Texas's discriminatory photo ID law, challenges to North Carolina's monster voter suppression law. It's important that we have judges who will fairly interpret the law and the Constitution to ensure just outcomes. That said, we have nominees under this president, such as Thomas Farr, who's been nominated for a seat in North Carolina. I'll note that in this particular district in North Carolina, there hasn't been a single African-American appointed to the court in its 143-year history. Trump has nonetheless nominated Farr for that seat, and he's somebody who has built a career promoting voter suppression. He defended North Carolina's voter suppression law, a law that was found by a federal court to have discriminated against minority voters with, quote, almost surgical precision. He's nominated folks like Brett Talley, who defended the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
He has nominated folks like Jeff Mateer, who described transgender children as part of Satan's plan. These are folks who bring a bias and cannot be entrusted with the great responsibility of fairly interpreting the law. That's the case whether we're talking about civil rights laws, constitutional law, corporate law, or any kind of law. Mm-hmm. Americans deserve justices and judges who will be fair and independent and, again, apply the law fairly regardless of the context.
Right. We should note also in what you mentioned, Jeff Mateer and Brett Talley, of course, are no longer nominees either. Zoe, can you tell us briefly, we have about a minute, exactly what the process was for even finding people like that to nominate?
So for district court nominees, a lot of it really is from the home state senators. The White House tends to give a fair amount of deference to, you know, in Battaglia's case, the Alabama senators, and Jeff Matier's case, Texas senators. Matthew Peterson for the D.C. court was a different story. He came out of the SEC. D.C. does not have a home state senator, but he had served with White House counsel Don McGahn, so he was an unknown entity to the White House counsel's office. But for D.C. circuit nominees, you know, we know that the White House is actively involved. They're talking to other conservative members of the legal community, and, you know, it's there's a network of conservative lawyers that know each other and help support each other as they move up in their careers. And that's how, you know, in some cases, names are getting to the White House. There's this network that exists.
So the president isn't necessarily, you know, taking active role in that. It's just kind of getting recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, especially for the lower courts, names tend to kind of trickle up to the White House, and then ultimately recommendations are made to the president. For very high-profile seats, the president may take a more active role, but it's not unusual for the president to defer in many cases to what members of the White House counsel's office and to the home state senators for district court judges.
All right, everyone hold their thoughts. We're going to take a quick break and then continue our conversation about President Trump and the impact he's making with his federal court nominations. Before we go to the break, I want to ask you to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your audio on demand. And if you like us, please leave us a review. Secondly, we want to hear from you about the tax cut bill and income inequality. Call us at 424-272-7082 and leave us a voicemail message. We may play your thoughts on the air. Now, if you missed that phone number or any of our previous episodes, go to kcrw.org/one year later. Welcome back. I'm Jamil Smith, and this is One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking about the success that President Trump has had in appointing federal judges and the lasting impact that might have. We have Zoe Tillman, Elizabeth Wydra, and Kristen Clark with us. Elizabeth, I'd like to start with you. I want to ask you about the Federalist Society suggesting appeals courts, judges, you know, to nominate, essentially. You know, in the process that Zoe was describing, it seems like the president really just kind of takes recommendations, doesn't really take too much of an active role. How much damage then could the Federalist Society do in, you know, putting forth nominees?
So the Federalist Society is a conservative organization of lawyers and academics that has, it does embrace a variety of conservative views. They are generally very, very conservative. They, for example, are generally not big fans of the administrative state. Well, that sounds wonky. It's basically a word that stands in for all of these protections that keep Americans safe and healthy, give us clean air, safe food, you know, make sure that the water is clean, all of these sorts of things that are very important to us. And so while it's not necessarily a bad thing for groups to provide suggestions to the president on who would make a good judge, it's incredibly important that the White House itself go through the vetting process because, first of all, that's what the Constitution requires. It is the president's job to put forth names for the federal judiciary and, of course, the Senate's job to advise and consent on those. You can't outsource that constitutional duty. But, you know, we have seen a failure of constitutional competence with this administration. So it's not terribly surprising, unfortunately, that we've seen some nominees get through who perhaps are there more because they're cronies of someone in the administration or because they have a particular ideological bent. So that's really what's concerning. And then second, what is also concerning about perhaps outsourcing this important job of putting forth names is that we have seen what Kristen described as an unprecedented in recent decades white male class of nominees being put forth. And that's very unfortunate after the progress made in the Obama administration to make sure that we had a judiciary that looked more like America.
Kristen Clark, I want to ask you to follow up on that. Of course, there's liberal groups that push their nominees as well. shouldn't conservatives have their opportunity to do so, especially with Republican majority in both houses and a president in the White House?
I think it's important to draw on a variety of sources to make sure that you have a strong list of qualified nominees who will be fair and independent for these critical appointments. We can't forget that judges, federal judges, have lifetime tenure. They're there for life. This is no small task or job. And what we've seen from the Obama administration is a complete failure to construct a diverse list of nominees for the Senate's consideration.
You mean the Trump administration?
I'm sorry. Trump administration, that's right. And reversal on the progress that we saw during the Obama administration. So, I think that it is problematic when they are relying on one source, whether that source is the Federalist Society or whoever it might be, because the reversal on progress is truly astounding. And it really turns the clock back and really stands as a threat to the integrity of our courts. The public has confidence in the judicial system when we have courts that reflect the diversity of the communities they serve. And that's not happening.
Zoe Tillman, I want to ask you specifically that we've just gotten the news that the tax cut bill, has been passed in the House. And surely there have been many legal challenges promised to that bill should it become law. The fact that the judiciary is being shaped the way that it is, could we see maybe a little bit more leniency for Trump's policies if they are, in fact, challenged in courts where he's nominated justices?
I don't know that you would see such a direct correlation. You know, it really depends on what courts challenges are brought in. You know, historically, depending on which side you're coming from, you try to find a court that has more of a lean to the left or right. So, for instance, on the travel ban, we've seen challenges brought in courts in Seattle, in Hawaii, in Maryland, benches that, for now at least, tend to lean left, and there's not a lot of vacancies on those courts. So I don't know that we'll get to see the Trump administration make any changes there, at least not in the near term. And, you know, when these cases are filed, they're randomly assigned to judges, so there's no way for this administration or for challengers to predict what judge they'll get. Mm-hmm. But I think big picture, the more judges, especially on the appeals courts, that the administration does get confirmed, I think it's more of a long-term effect that we'll start to see as far as shifts in particular circuits. Certainly on the Supreme Court, you see that more imminently, I would say. But I don't know that we would see an immediate impact as we start to see tax bill cases come up. I think it's more of a long term, as you know, Elizabeth was saying, what's going to happen with the administrative state generally? And, you know, 10 years from now, are we going to start to see a lot more rulings come down that restrict the role of the federal government and the authority of federal agencies? So it's not always as immediate, but mm-hmm. again, this is why it's so important for whoever is in power getting judges. That's why it's always a priority, is because of this long-term impact.
Elizabeth Wydra, I want to ask you about the American Bar Association, which conservatives have been claiming has a left-wing bias. They've rated four of Trump's nominees as not qualified. Now, that many nominees getting that kind of rating, is that usual? And are you concerned about the courts becoming politicized and, frankly, you know, more incompetent with nominees who don't know maybe what they're doing?
So that is absolutely not usual. It's very unusual to have judicial nominees rated not qualified and to have so many, as you said, four, so soon in an administration. President Obama, I don't think had any. And during the Bush years, I think there were maybe one or two. So it's very unusual. And, you know, the American Bar Association is the National Association of Lawyers. And certainly some conservatives think it's perhaps a little more liberal, but it's certainly not some hotbed of liberal resistance. They very carefully vet these nominees by doing interviews, looking through their record, and put forth reasons. For example, in one of the cases of someone who, Judge Gratz, who has already been confirmed, they found that he would not be able to put aside his personal bias, particularly on issues like reproductive rights, something that's incredibly important to women and families across this country. And it is so important that we have judges on the bench who are qualified and will be fair and will apply the law as it is without bias. Because as you raised with the tax bill, the courts are a crucial constitutional check on the political branches. We've seen this with the discriminatory travel and refugee ban. The importance of the courts to say, look, we have to respect constitutional liberties and rights for all. We are a place where if you don't have political power, you can come and have your rights respected. You can stand on the Constitution and have it enforced. Kristen talked about voting rights. You can have communities of color who are being excluded from the ballot box come to the court and get their rights validated. You can have people who are facing unsafe working conditions or job discrimination from powerful corporations, and they can go to the courts, and because this isn't a political institution, it's not supposed to be a political institution, they can have the law applied fairly to them and get judgments in their favor. Mm-hmm. And so if Americans start thinking of the courts as full of these not qualified, basically political hacks, we are going to have an extremely dangerous erosion of the trust and belief in the fairness of our federal judiciary, which is crucial in our constitutional system.
We're talking about the federal courts under the administration of President Trump. You're listening to One Year Later. Kristen Clark, I want to ask you about Senator John Kennedy, who we heard in the soundbite earlier. He's a Republican. He's a lawyer. He's pushing back against Trump and his nominees. But we're still seeing folks like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski in the Senate voting for nominees who aren't pro-choice and who are hostile to the rights of LGBTQ Americans. Can you help reconcile that for those of us who are observing from the outside?
Well, you know, I want to make sure that we have two things that are clear. There should not be a political litmus test for judicial nominees. As Elizabeth notes, we want judges who don't bring their biases with them. We want judges who don't have a track record of defending the KKK. We want people who have not expressed and harbored bias against transgendered people or other minority communities. We deserve judges who can do their job ably, professionally, and be fair and independent. What's happening now is we're seeing senators essentially rubber stamp nominees who have very troubling track records. John Bush is somebody who was confirmed in July who compared abortion to slavery, and he is someone who opposed same-sex marriage. We need the senators to do their job and properly vet these nominees and provide advice and consent. You know, Senator Kennedy indicated that at some point over the last few days he had an exchange with Trump over Peterson, and Trump indicated, "Hey, thanks for doing your job. If we pass on someone who's unqualified, you know, I expect you to do your job and let me know." To me, it's disgraceful that this administration is not taking this task more seriously. The judicial branch is one of the three branches of our government. It is a critical and important branch. It's a branch that resolves cases and controversies. It's part of the checks and balances in our system, and we don't need politics infecting the process. We don't need to see the politicization of how we're selecting judges, nor do we need to see individuals who harbor tremendous bias securing lifetime seats on our federal courts.
Zoe Tillman, I want to ask you about Alabama Senator-elect Doug Jones. He's a former federal prosecutor who, whenever he is seated, will presumably get a seat on the Judiciary Committee, replacing the departed Al Franken. Franken, for all of his faults, has been a tough presence on that committee. Can we anticipate that Doug Jones would be the same?
So I'm actually not so familiar on the politics side. I don't know about Doug Jones and where he'll end up in the Senate. But I think what's going to be really interesting to see is what's going to happen with that Alabama seat that Brett Talley was intended for. Normally, the White House, you know, there's an advise and consent role that the Senate plays, and that's where you see home state senators putting forward preferred nominees. And historically, there have been certain rules in place that give home state senators some leverage with the White House and leverage on the Judiciary Committee and in the confirmation process. And, you know, we'll now have a Democrat in a historically red state, and it'll be interesting to see if the White House, you know, how much they want to consult with him, how much of a say he'll have in who is nominated for that Alabama seat and for other, you know, Alabama vacancies going forward. But it really narrows what was already a pretty slim majority that the Republicans have in the Senate. As we saw with Senator Kennedy, you know, it really just can take one on the right to present a lot of problems for the White House. And so now that majority has been narrowed, I think Doug Jones presents yet another problem and a barrier for the White House in getting nominees through as quickly as possible.
Elizabeth Weidrich, we have about a minute left. I want to ask you about these nominees. They're not really being approved on a bipartisan basis. Will this increase the chances that the course will, in fact, inevitably become more politicized?
You know, I certainly hope not, but it does certainly raise that specter. We used to have several ways in which that we could slightly depoliticize the judicial nominations process. We used to require 60 votes for first all appellate courts and then just for the Supreme Court. But now that has gone away even for the Supreme Court. And most Americans want 60 vote threshold for someone who's going to have such an important lifetime appointment. And in this administration, we've also seen the Senate Judiciary Committee led by Republicans do away with that consultation process with the home state senators that Zoe talked about. That was one way that you could work with bipartisan efforts. If you had a Democratic senator working with a Republican president, they would have to work together to come up with a nominee. But the Trump administration has apparently refused to do that, even with its own Republican senators. That's what we saw with Senator Kennedy with this Kyle Duncan nomination that he didn't even know was coming forth until he got a call from the White House counsel. So a lot of the ways in which we have depoliticized the court.
Sorry, I guess we lost Elizabeth in the middle of that sentence. We want to end this segment there. We want to thank Zoe Tillman, Kristen Clark, and Elizabeth Weidrich for joining us. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with One Year Later from KCRW. I'm Jamil Smith. Welcome back to One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out, where we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. I'll be on the left as usual, and we have Josh Barrow in studio today at the center. He is the senior editor for Business Insider and the co-host of Left, Right, and Center, our sister program. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Good to be here with you.
Now, you published two columns while you were headed out here to Los Angeles. Let's talk about them one at a time.
Okay.
First, the Republican tax bill. Now, members of the House just, you know, voted earlier today to pass the reconciled tax cut. The Senate may vote later tonight. It's very unpopular, mostly benefits the rich, and threatens to widen economic inequality. Is there anything good in it?
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, I don't think it's a good bill on balance, but I think it's actually gotten a little bit of a worse rap than it deserves. I mean, for example, according to the Tax Policy Center, about 80% of Americans will get a tax cut in the first year under the bill. The New York Times did a poll with SurveyMonkey and found that only 32% of respondents believed that they were going to get a tax cut. So literally more than half the people who will get a tax cut next year under this bill think they're not going to get a tax cut. So for a lot of people's individual economic circumstances, this bill is better than they think, at least initially. Now, there is this issue over time. Some of those tax cuts erode. Some of them also expire. And Republicans say, well, Congress will extend those in the future. And there are a lot of features of our tax code that are weirdly written to expire every so often, and Congress goes back and renews them. So it's not a crazy thing to say that they'll get renewed, but it certainly creates that uncertainty. But, you know, the policy, at least for the next few years and probably longer, does give a lot of these people tax cuts. It really does make taxes simpler for a lot of people. It greatly reduces the number of people who will need to take itemized deductions. And it probably will cause the economy to grow a little bit faster. Now, even when you look at, for example, that Tax Policy Center analysis, and Tax Policy Center is a joint project of two center-left think tanks in Washington, D.C., and they find a very small but positive economic effect from the bill. And it's, you know, when you cut corporate taxes, it does somewhat at the margin encourage people to make business investments and cause some amount of job growth. The flip side of it is that in the long run, when the government runs up more debt, that's bad for the economy. But because interest rates are so low right now, the government debt is actually not as much of a concern as it might be at another time. So this probably will improve economic performance a little bit, but then most of that benefit is going to go to people who own companies, who own stocks, so it will accrue disproportionately to the top. So I don't think it's a good bill, but I think that there are more upsides to the bill than people sometimes realize.
I want to go to what the Democrats have been saying about this. This is Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi saying that this bill is not in the Christmas spirit.
In this holy time, the moral obscenity and unrepentant greed of the GOP tax scam stands out even more clearly. As the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops said early on, here it is, this proposal appears to be the first federal income tax modification in American history that will raise income taxes on the working poor while simultaneously providing a large tax cut to the wealthy. The bishops go on to say, this is simply unconscionable. They'll be cheering it, unconscionable.
This is an incredibly far-reaching bill. Is she on point with any of that?
Well, so there's this kind of surprisingly technical debate about this question of a tax increase on the working poor, because one of the things the bill does is it repeals the individual mandate in Obamacare. And this actually saves the government money, even though people won't pay those penalties anymore. More people will not carry health insurance. They won't buy a plan because they're no longer required to. They'll decline their employer's offer of insurance if the employer requires them to pay a really large fraction of the premium. And so in a lot of cases, those taxpayers will be giving up subsidies that were available to them. Instead of going and buying from the exchange with the government paying for part of the premium, they choose just not to buy at all. That subsidy is counted as a tax cut, essentially, for that low-income worker. Because the premium subsidies are technically structured as tax credits, it's like it reduces your tax bill. So that's why some of those taxpayers are showing up as having a tax increase. It's because they would have carried health insurance before. Now they're not. And now what Republicans say is, well, they were buying the health insurance because they were under the threat of this penalty. They found the health insurance to be a bad deal, excessively expensive, and they're now making the choice not to carry it. So it shouldn't count as a tax increase. Now, I think if you ask most of those workers, what they want is they don't want the freedom to go uninsured. They also don't want the status quo, where they find the plans that they're being offered in the Obamacare exchanges to be too expensive and not cover enough. They want insurance that they would find to be a good value. So I think, you know, those people are not getting what they ought to get out of the government. I don't think it's entirely clear that that should be counted as a tax increase, because those subsidies remain available to them if they choose to buy health insurance. They don't. In the long run, though, the picture is correct, which is to say that this bill, its benefits are weighted toward the rich, and they become more weighted toward the rich over time, because the corporate tax cuts are permanent. The individual tax cuts are not only temporary, they change some of the rules around how taxes are adjusted every year for inflation, and that basically causes the tax cut to get eaten away a little bit one year to the next, and the bite is small each year. But over time, that actually takes away a substantial part of the individual tax cuts.
Now, there's been some criticism, of course, in the last few days of Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, looking at a provision that apparently is going to benefit him personally. Mm-hmm. To what extent should this, you know, people be concerned about this tax cut benefiting these senators and members of the House personally?
I think for years we're going to be finding provisions buried in this bill that provide, you know, surprise Easter egg tax benefits to all sorts of people. Now Corker's office swears up and down that he was not involved in the drafting of that provision. Corker is hardly the only person who owns real estate through a pass-through entity. Corker's a rich guy. A lot of rich guys have investments like that. So while he will benefit from it, so will a lot of other people, including a number of other lawmakers. Some of the speculation that's been going around Washington is that the real reason Corker switched his vote was that John McCain, because of his very serious illness, he wanted to be able to go away to Arizona for treatment. And that if Corker was a no vote and there was some other stuff up in the air, that would essentially force John McCain to stay in Washington to be available to vote for the bill. So that is one possible reason out there that's why Corker changed his vote. I mean, the problem is when you make laws behind closed doors like this, you're depending on the assurance of Bob Corker and Orrin Orrin Hatch when they tell you, no, Bob Corker had nothing to do with this provision that will save Bob Corker a bunch of money.
It's hard to assume good intentions when, in fact, you know, you see these kinds of benefits.
Yeah.
I want to pivot to your other column on the newly elected Virginia Governor Ralph Northam.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed on Twitter yesterday that he's coming under fire from some liberals about how he's approaching the Medicaid expansion in his commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
First, can you explain what Northam is doing?
Yeah, sure. So Virginia is one of, I believe it's 18 states now that have not expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. The federal government pays 90% of the bill for that. So it's a really good deal for these states to get a lot of people on health insurance. But Republicans in many states have opposed it, including in Virginia, where Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, has been very aggressive calling for Medicaid expansion. But he faced an enormous Republican majority in one house of his state legislature, and Republicans wouldn't give that to him. Now, Northam has been elected by a wide margin, and Democrats picked up so many seats in that legislature that now Republicans will either have a one-seat majority, it'll be 51-49, or there's a recount going on right now where the margin's literally 5 votes. So Democrats are actually likely to end up with 50-50 in that House. But basically, the consequence is Democrats have done really well. The GOP has been beaten back because their opposition to Medicaid expansion was so unpopular. But he will still need at least a couple of Republican votes if he's going to get a Medicaid expansion plan through in Virginia. And so basically what Northam was saying was, you know, well, I want to work with Republicans on cost control and managed care. And, you know, Medicaid spending has been growing at 5-7% a year, which is unsustainable. So I retain my commitment to Medicaid expansion, but I also want to make sure that we get costs under control. This was taken by a lot of liberals as him basically, you know, folding away from a position that had been core for Democrats. My view on it is basically, look, you know, the political reality is you're going to need some Republican votes to get this done. There are a number of states where Medicaid expansion has happened with split control or Republican control.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually been on terms similar to what Northam is laying out here, basically, where, you know, you do the coverage expansion, you do it through managed care HMO type plans that try to control costs. A lot of those are actually very effective at controlling costs while providing quality care. So I think he's, you know, the question is, do you want someone who says all the right things about Medicaid, or do you want someone who actually finds a way to get a Medicaid expansion deal through the Virginia legislature? So I think that what he's saying is practical and is likely to lead to that end. And if Republicans say no, 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 then I think Republicans will have another very bad year 2 years from now when Virginia has elections again.
One of the points that you make in the column addresses Terry McAuliffe, the former governor, and his approach.
Yeah.
How did that differ from what Northam is doing?
Well, so, I mean, McAuliffe, because McAuliffe had... there was a 2-1 Republican majority in the legislature under McAuliffe. So he didn't have the option of trying to pick off 2 or 3 Republicans and getting a Medicaid expansion plan passed. So basically what he did was he just hammered Republicans over and over for, you know, why won't you expand Medicaid? This is popular, sending them proposals for it over and over. And it didn't work. And that wasn't really Terry McAuliffe's fault. He didn't have the votes to get it done.
Right.
But the thing is, you know, and in fact, it probably laid some of the groundwork that helped Northam win by so much and helped Democrats pick up so many seats. But now the task that Northam faces is different from the task that McAuliffe faces. It's not a messaging battle. It's a legislative battle, finding a way to get enough Republicans to agree with you to do this. And I think that, you know, the experience in states like Arizona and Arkansas and Alaska, a lot of places where you've had bipartisan expansions of Medicaid, there are lessons about how to do that, how to get Republicans on board. I think he's trying to follow that lesson. And you want your party's officials to, you know, stay true to their principles, but you also want them to deal in the art of the possible and get positive results like lots more people on Medicaid.
Right. Now, normally I side with effectiveness over message. But I understand why liberals would have a problem with what Northam is doing, because at the end of the day, you know, politics is a lot about presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he may be doing some long-term damage? Because I think that that's actually really possible.
Well, people said that a lot during the campaign, too. There was all this pre-mortem of Ralph Northam's campaign. He's blowing this election. He's going to lose in Virginia and all the, you know, and wherever you were in the Democratic Party, people were saying, you know, well, he's not energizing black voters, that he, you know, the Bernie people were saying that he's, you know, he's not doing enough for progressives. He's not showing us that he's, you know, a true enough force in our direction.
Right.
And then he won by 9 points. He, like, greatly beat the polls. So I think, you know, people said that Ralph Northam was damaging the brand before the election when he ran an ad saying that he would work with Donald Trump if Donald Trump was right about things. And it turned out that that was not damaging the brand, that he did quite well. Now, I do think there's a role for activists to play pushing politicians. So, you know, it's fine to yell at him so long as you understand that, you know, he's working on your side and your role here is to yell to help get to the end that he's working toward.
All right. Thank you to my guest, Josh Barrow, senior editor for Business Insider and the co-host of our sister program, Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks, Jamil.
That's it for us today on 1 Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show on The Wealth Gap. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your audio on demand. And if you liked us, leave us a review. Today's last note, in the spirit of judges who get lifetime gigs, is Make It Last Forever by Keith Sweat. One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Los Angeles and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.